Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Mike Colomeco from Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host today, Brianna Kurtz, and I'm so excited to be with you and very excited about our guest. He's a popular guy, and we've been trying to get him on the show for quite some time. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Bryant Terry, author of Afro-Vegan, Farm Fresh, African, Caribbean, and Southern Flavors Remix to the show. Hi, Bryant.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. How are you?
Doing really well, just getting up over here on the West Coast, but, you know.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us and finally getting you on the show. I know we're so excited to have you.
No, I so love everything that you guys do over at Heritage Network, and I'm really excited to be here. So thank you for having me on.
So let's jump right in. This is your fourth, I think your fourth titled book, correct? And I know you worked on other projects. So can you tell me
this is the third book that I've solely authored.
Okay.
And then my first book was co-authored with my friend Anna LePay. So technically my third book, but I've published four books.
Okay, got that straight now. Can you tell me a little bit about how this book is different from your first two, or how you kind of, it's building on the first two?
Well, one, I actually know how to write a cookbook now.
Lessons learned.
Yeah, no, I love my two prior books, but, you know, I realized that everything's a stepping stone, and I feel like those books were preparing me to write this book, just in terms of honing my craft and, you know, not only in cookbook writing, but just becoming a better chef. And, but I think, you know, in terms of the theme, the thread that's run throughout my work has been really celebrating not just African-American cuisine, but more broadly Afro-diasporic cuisine, and really helping to reframe the narrative, shifting it away from it being, you know, particularly African-American cuisine being like just, you know, all bad, the bane of African-American health, you know, nothing but like horrible comfort foods, and really helping people understand that at its core, the origins of African-American cuisine are, you know, I think the type of foods that any Western-trained allopathic physician or dietitian or naturopath would say we should all be eating, you know, nutrient-rich leafy greens and tubers and, you know, things like butter beans and black-eyed peas and sugar snap peas and pole beans and dandelions and kale. And, you know, these are all really nutrient-rich foods, and I just want people to, you know, really understand that is, you know, certainly not rejecting the comfort foods of the cuisine, like fried chicken and red velvet cake and whatever else people might eat on holidays and celebrations, but helping people understand that in terms of, you know, historically, the foods that people ate on an everyday basis were just farm fresh, real ingredients.
And the result of the book came out absolutely beautifully. And about all those ingredients, all those beans and greens and whatnot, where did the recipes come from? Were you inspired just by the ingredients? Did you travel, collect, did a lot of recipe testing, come from your family?
Yeah, all of the above. Mm-hmm. You know, the book was really inspired. I described my approach to the book in the introductory essay, and I really approached it as a collagist, inspired by one of my favorite visual artists, African-American artist Romare Bearden, who did these beautiful collages that, you know, reflect the African-American history and culture. But that was my approach to this book, because I really wanted to think about the African diaspora as a whole, food coming from not just West and Central Africa, where most, you know, Africans were taken during the transatlantic slave trade and brought to the Caribbean and to America, but really looking at the whole continent and the diverse cuisines throughout all of Africa, and just kind of cutting and pasting different flavor profiles and ingredients in classic dishes and coming up with things that are completely new. So they were certainly inspired by, you know, home-cooked meals that I had growing up or from friends who come from the Caribbean and the African continent, from my vast collection of cookbooks from different restaurants that I've visited around the world, you know, interesting websites, narrative histories, scholarly monographs about African-American and Afro-diaspora food, and traveling. And so all those things were just this fodder for me to really come up with, you know, over 100 recipes.
Well, and I feel like, I know you live in Northern California now, but you are from the South, yes, and you've lived a lot of different places. Have, like, each individual place influenced you in some way?
Yeah, for sure. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and have, you know, my family historically has roots in rural Mississippi, where we actually own farms, and I spend a lot of time in summers on our family's farms. And then I moved to New Orleans for college, went to Xavier University in New Orleans. And so, you know, I mean, obviously Memphis being like the barbecue capital of the world.
Yeah.
And more so than just the barbecue, but just having family who, you know, understood the importance of growing your own food. And most of the food that we got was from our family farms and community or home gardens, and always farm fresh. We pickled and canned and preserved, you know, a lot of the surplus that we had for the winter. And so that you know, that ethos certainly inspires and kind of informs the way that I just move through the world, but certainly my cookbook writing. And then living in New Orleans, I mean, come on, like Cajun Creole cuisine, I mean, it's just so compelling and delicious that I feel like in terms of my approach to cooking, it's certainly more than any other cuisine informs the way that I think about cooking. And if you consider, you know, the different groups that have kind of made up Louisiana, from the French to the Spanish to Africans to, you know, Native Americans, like it truly is this type of hybrid cuisine that I strive to, you know, create in my own cookbook writing, looking at all these various world cuisines and bringing them together into something that's cohesive.
And I think it really comes through because it takes someone with your experience in all these different exciting food places to kind of bring it all together for us. So it definitely translates. So our very own Jessica B. Harris, the host of Heritage Radio's My Welcome Table, wrote the introduction for your book. And she's just such an amazing woman, amazing person, a wealth of knowledge. Was she a resource for this book?
She's always been a resource for me in terms of just, you know, having an inspiring kind of mentor, guiding light, someone who has, you know, I mean, I hope to one day be as prolific as Jessica B. Harris, but I love the way that she combines, you know, scholarly approaches to cooking and food culture with cookbook writing and really bringing together the recipes from the African diaspora, but also telling the stories and recounting the histories and helping people to have a much deeper understanding of this beautiful, complex world cuisine. And, you know, I reached out to Jessica about the time that I wrote my second book, Vegan Soul Kitchen, and asked if she would, you know, just kind of mentor me and help me understand the process of writing books and navigating the publishing world. And she's just been a great resource. And so for me, it was such an honor to have her write the foreword for this book. I mean, it was like, yeah, just having, I don't know, Jesus come and write it or something. Like, you know, she was just, so she's always been so generous. And I feel like she beautifully kind of framed what I was trying to get across. And yeah, much love to Jessica.
Well, I want to go back to something that you brought up. You mentioned the inspiration from Ramar Bearden, the artist. And I want to talk about how you really encompass art in your book, or how you try to bring it in using film, music, books. So, for example, you have a Za'atar recipe, and you have Crescent by John Coltrane, and Za'atar Diva by, Sahir Hamad, I think is how you say it, listed as pairing. So can you tell me about why you decided to do that, and then how you did it?
Well, you know, I think it was Wendell Berry who said that we need to be bringing the culture back into agriculture.
Yes, that's
and
true.
For me, it's really been a large part of my mission is kind of bridging this artificial chasm that I think industrial food has created over the past 60, 70 years or whatever, that has food on one side and art and culture and community way over somewhere else on another side. And so I really want to bring those things together. And in much of my work, I don't know if the listeners are aware, but I actually, my work as a cookbook author came from or evolved from my work as a grassroots activist around health food and farming issues. So I started when I was living in Brooklyn. I founded an organization called Be Healthy that worked with young people and using food, cooking, and just engaging, you know, agricultural systems as a way to politicize them and move them to be food justice activists in their communities and work towards creating more healthy and sustainable food sources in their geographic communities. And one of the things that we really felt was important for us to do in the work with the young people is using art and culture and music as a way to get them thinking more deeply about these issues. So not starting with the public policy or the heady intellectual ideas, but doing something that's much more visceral and moving with the food, with the music, with the art, with the culture, and then moving eventually to the ideas and to the public policy issues. And, you know, I almost see it as a kind of second and third layer of the book. If you think about just like the way in which, I introduce certain films. So for example, with my Jamaican patties, I suggested people watch, what's the name of that film? Life and Debt by Stephanie Black, that talks about the way in which economic globalization has affected the agricultural industries in a lot of Caribbean countries, particularly Jamaica. And so rather than, you know, going off on some, I mean, haranguing people about that, I just offer a resource and people can actually go and read it. And so for the Vegan Soul Kitchen, I was joking with my wife about it the other night because the soundtrack for that book, you know, I pair each recipe with a suggested soundtrack or a song.
Yep.
Like, it was so meticulously put together. I probably spent too many hours on it. But if one were to listen to the music, just the music all the way through, it tells a story in and of itself. And I was really intentional about that. But now that I have two daughters, I wasn't able to be as, kind of engrossed in that process. So I actually invited different friends to help me create the soundtracks for Afro Vegan. So, you know, my music writer friend, Dream Hampton, my DJ friend, David Maduli, my friend who's a professor and music writer, Florence Lafargue, and all these different friends who are somehow connected to music. I was just like, let me just bring people in. So I kind of jokingly say it takes a village to write a cookbook because I had so many different friends.
Well, it sounds like a really fun part of the process.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool to bring other people in. I think that you respect and you know they have some kind of perspective because it's kind of like, well, what does this mean to you? And that's, you know, it translates. If it means something to someone, it's probably going to mean something to someone else as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting and really original. I haven't really seen that many other places, that kind of direct coupling of the art and the food.
Yep.
So have you been inspired by any other cookbooks? Like when you look at one, maybe some of your favorites that really helped guide you along the way when you were designing and thinking about your cookbook?
Yeah, well, I take pride in my cookbook collection. and, you know, they just serve as such a major source of inspiration. I mean, I look at them almost every day, and not just cookbooks, but large format art books as well. But one of the books that was really inspiring to me in terms of the actual aesthetic of the book was Nancy Hashui. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Nancy Singleton Hashui, I think is her Japanese name, but anyway, Japanese farm food.
That's an amazing book. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, and actually, you say that, I kind of see the parallels between hers and yours a little bit.
Well, one of the things, the thing that inspired me the most about that book was I love the beautiful the textile that she had on the spine of the book.
Yes.
And when we were thinking about that, when I was, you know, talking to the art director at Tennessee Press about the aesthetic, I was like, I want an African textile design in my book. And I showed her that book, and she made it work. And I feel like it adds so much texture and beauty to the book itself. But, I have to say, I feel so lucky to be on Tennessee Press, because so many of my favorite cookbook authors and so many of my favorite cookbooks are published by 10 Feet. Mm-hmm. Charles Fon's book, Vietnamese Home Cooking, to, I don't know, Man Reza by David Kent.
Do you
like that book?
Yeah, no, I do, but there's so many now that are coming out that are just so... from 10 Speed. It's like every day I feel like there's a new one, and they're all lovely.
I know. I'm really inspired by a lot of, you know, I think now a lot of books that are being published in America are just amazing and beautiful and awesome. But before I started, I don't know, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, I was really into a lot of the books coming out of the UK. Mm-hmm. I feel like the UK and Australia, I feel like a lot of the books that were being published there were just kind of in line with my aesthetic. So I like Sky Gingell's books, My Favorite Ingredient, A Year in My Kitchen. So many.
I'll Interesting. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but before we do, I know when we were emailing, I got some out of offices from you that you were on paternity leave. So I think congratulations are in order.
Thank you.
Two now. Is that right?
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old and a 9-week-old.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you have an absolutely beautiful family. You're going to have to update that photo in the back of your book, because it's just a beautiful picture of your family. Does she like your food, or do you have to do like a kid-friendly version of some stuff? Does she help out in the kitchen yet, your older daughter?
Yes. Our older daughter, she helps out in the kitchen. She's been helping out since she was, I don't know, a little before 2 years old. We would have her we'd set our little station up on the ground, and we would get like leafy greens from our garden. And then we'd have like a couple bowls where she would like wash them in each bowl and put them in the colander. And then we'd have her tear the greens up. And so, we feel like we wanted to get her involved as quickly as possible. And we don't believe in this whole thing around you make a different meal for the kids. It's like, uh-huh, you eat what we eat, or you just don't eat anything. So she has a very adventuresome palate as a result of that.
Well, excellent. All right, Bryant, we're going to take a quick break and hear from one of our wonderful sponsors. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about Afro-vegans. Stay with us.
Okay.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
All right, welcome back to Eat Your Words here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and I'm speaking with Bryant Terry, author of Afro-Vegan. So, Bryant, I want to hear about your vegan experience. I know we talked about Memphis, we talked about barbecue, so... how long have you been vegan, or was there a point you became vegan, and like when and why?
Well, I first started experimenting with vegetarian and veganism late in high school, and this goes back to the use of art and culture in my work, because it was a song that actually inspired my kind of shift in my habits and attitudes and politics around food and eating. And the song was Beef by Boogie Down Productions and KRS-One, in which he says, "Beef, what a relief. When will this poisonous product cease? This is another public service announcement. You can believe it or you can doubt it. And he goes on and has this very brilliant kind of deconstruction of our food system and, you know, talking about factory farming and its effect on not only the animals, but, you know, human health and the environment. And, you know, I was so moved by that I became whatever your perception or the stereotype that you might have of the most annoying, self-righteous, dogmatic, finger-wagging vegan. Like, that's what I became after hearing that song. And it was so important for me to go through that phase. And the people who had it on my wrath more than anyone were my parents. And I just feel so bad that I put them through that now as a parent. But, you know, it really helped me to understand that the least effective way of helping people think differently about their consumption choices or, you know, just the way that they're relating to food is by yelling at them and screaming at them and making them feel bad for where they are. And so, you know, I feel like it was important for me to go through that phase because now as a thinker, a writer, an educator around these issues, it helps me to understand the ways in which you can effectively get people to think differently about you know, eating and consumption, because it's so personal. It's like, don't tell me what to eat. Don't you know, who are you to be wagging your finger in my face? And so, but, you know, it wasn't a linear journey since then. Like, I didn't become vegan, and then I just stopped eating any animal products. I studied abroad in France when I was in college, and, you know, back in the early, mid-90s, it was hard to be a vegan in France, and my host family was feeding me a lot of yogurt and cheeses, and so, you know, I had a little moment where I shifted away from that, and then when I was living in Brooklyn in grad school at NYU, I had this phase where I was eating fish again, but right now, I'm a vegan. I don't eat any animal products, and it feels good to me, and it feels good in terms of my values and how I want to live in this world. But, you know, I just think it's important for people to really be driven by their own values and what their body needs instead of just kind of choosing whatever they might imagine is the best diet and then following the script accordingly. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it's kind of, you know, practice what you preach. So, and letting it kind of live through your actions and your lifestyle, like you said. So, yep. And you talk about vegetarianism, you know, kind of as the path towards a healthy lifestyle as well in the introduction. And it really comes from, it seems like a very heartfelt place about health issues in America, particularly statistics related to the African-American population regarding heart disease and diabetes and obesity and et cetera. So, and, you know, you're often shown in this light of food justice. So can you talk a little bit about the issues of food justice and what that means to you and how we can use our food?
Yeah, well, as I said, before I even, you know, started writing cookbooks or publishing at all, I was working as a grassroots activist in New York. And, you know, I had this moment where I understood that so many communities, usually communities that were, you know, working class, working poor in the outer boroughs, when you went to these communities, there were very few sources of accessing healthy, fresh, affordable food. And there were just, you know, a plethora of resources for getting the worst food. Lots of bodegas, you know, processed food, packaged food, alcohol, tobacco, you know, the foods that are highest in sugar, fat, and salt, and low in nutrients that we need. And then there are a lot of fast food restaurants in the community. And statistically, we know that these are the communities that are suffering the highest rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes and heart disease and certain cancers. And inspired by some research that I was doing in grad school at NYU, looking at the work of the Black Panthers in the Bay Area and then, you know, increasingly nationally in the late 60s and 70s, I really felt that the larger social justice movement was remiss if it didn't address food access and the effect on public health. And so that thread is always going to run throughout my work about helping us think more deeply about the physical, geographic, and economic barriers that many communities have to accessing any fresh food at all, let alone culturally appropriate food, which is, you know, the thing that I've been focusing on, helping some of the most impacted communities, African-American communities in America, who are dealing with food injustice, who are dealing with food insecurity, who are dealing with, you know, these horrible diet-related illnesses to think about how their own cultural foods can be a part of them healing their mind, bodies, and spirits.
And I think, you know, you've been working in this space for a long time. So have you seen positive changes over time in your community? Do you feel good about the way things are, what direction things are going in?
I do. You know, I mean, from New York City to San Francisco Bay Area to places that I've just been traveling to over the past, for over a decade now, it's amazing just seeing the shifts occur. I mean, not only the proliferation of things like farmers markets, but, you know, people in communities actually owning and driving the solutions to community food insecurity, not having people come in and dictate how they should address these issues, but people who are from the community, stakeholders in the community, faith-based institutions, schools, community organizations, you know, working to increase more access to healthful food through, you know, food buying clubs and food co-ops and community gardens and home gardens, and just really saying that we care about our health. We know that this is a priority, and we're going to do something about it. So I feel very hopeful, and I think that, you know, these issues are obviously so much more a part of the public discourse than they were, what, 13 years ago when I first started doing this work. I mean, everybody from the White House to the grassroots are thinking about food issues. And so I feel like we've made a lot of progress.
Great. So I'm going to switch gears and kind of get back to the book. The first half of the show, we talked about Jessica B. Harris, and I want to bring up another guest appearance in the book, Michael Twitty. And for anyone unfamiliar with his work, he kind of operates in the same African-American culinary historian space. And he pens an epilogue of sorts in your book, and I was hoping you could speak about either working with him or maybe what he brought to the project.
You know, Michael just, he's just a brilliant guy. He inspires me the way he just kind of pushes in. And I love the way in which he brings in. It's like, you know, I just like it when people think creatively about educating people, and just his whole kind of like living performances that he does is kind of like, I don't know, it's almost like performance art where he does these period pieces going back and, you know, thinking about and practicing the different ways in which enslaved Africans might have cooked and eaten in the antebellum South, or, you know, his just provocative essays and talks about these issues. He really pushes people to think about, you know, health and food and agriculture and race in ways that a lot of people aren't. And so I just felt that he would be a brilliant addition to the book. And what I wanted him to bring to the book is to push people to think more about, you know, not just eating healthily and eating fresh, you know, home-cooked meals, but growing your food. I mean, that is a big piece that I want people to get back to. If they have the available space and the resources, to think about ways that we can work towards healing the earth by growing food and, you know, at our home if we have the space, or at community gardens, or, you know, somehow contributing to rural farms. But even if we can't grow it, supporting those people who are really working hard to feed all of us in a way that's in line with sustainability and health. So, you know, joining a CSA program, or getting food from your local farmers market, or farm stands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I feel like that was just the perfect sweet note to end the book on.
Excellent. So we're running out of time, but I mentioned we've been trying to talk to you for a while, and, you know, usually we have authors come on, like, when they're doing the main press tour or when they're on the road, and which is great, but I think it's kind of nice that we have you now after the, you know, you've taken your paternity leave, you did all the press in the spring, you were everywhere. I know we all saw you at the Food Book Fair here in New York. And so I kind of want to hear about, like, now that you have some 2020 vision to look at the experience of the book, how do you feel about it? How do you, are you moving forward now? Are you like, okay, we're done with that one. Like, let's move, and, you know, new projects start to come up.
It's funny. I felt like I got whiplash going from, like, the launch of the book. I did this crazy book release party in Oakland, Impact Hub Oakland, and 300 people came. We had, like, a live jazz band. We had African food being served, and it was just a beautiful night. And literally the next morning, I got on a flight to New York City, and I just didn't stop for 2 months, just traveling and, you know, stomping and promoting the book. And it was really fun. And I feel like it was a great way just to get a lot of momentum going, and allow me to kind of step away and feel good about it. And one of the cool things was the day, I think maybe like the day that I was putting my autoresponder on saying that I was going to be on paternity leave, I got a message that Amazon.com named it as one of the best cookbooks of 2014. It had only been out for 2 months.
Congratulations, yeah.
So that helped me feel good about just kind of stepping away and just spending time with family. But it was just so beautiful touring the country because, you know, I don't do just the typical bookstore events. I do, you know, farmers market cooking demos. Mm-hmm. I do pop-up.
No, you were here at Union Square, is that right?
Yeah, you know, an event at Union Square in Manhattan. And, you know, I think more than anything, just being able to connect with the people who appreciate my work and who have supported my work since 2006 when my first book was published, it means so much to me. And, you know, one of the things I did with this book, which was this is a practice I want to continue doing, is I crowdsourced. Before I even started writing, I actually went on my Facebook, went on my Twitter account, and then I told people about the general concept and asked people, like, what kind of recipes would you like to see? Like, what kind of, you know, what regions of the world or what countries or what different, you know, cuisines would you like represented in this book? And I got hundreds of answers. And so just to come full circle and to meet people who are just being like, oh, I remember I, you know, suggested that you use hibiscus or, you know, sorrel or whatever. And, you know, just connect with folks was beautiful.
Well, again, the result came out wonderfully. The book is beautiful. Everyone, if you haven't gotten it yet, go pick it up. Bryant Terry's Afro-Vegan. We are about out of time. Bryant, thank you so much for sharing with us today and for all of your thoughtful words. It was a pleasure to finally have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's all for Eat Your Words today. See you here next Monday at 1 p.m. when I'll be talking to James Casey, the founder and creative director of Swallow Magazine. See you then.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.